Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. We're trying something a little different to start our show tonight. We're going to start off with a song. This was suggested by one of our sponsors, The Spiritual UN. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. The New American Dream Radio Show supports the humanity's vision of the spiritual UN. Check it out at www.thespiritualun.org. Often, I introduce our show with a discussion of a recent book or movie. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the Olympics instead. Sportscaster Bob Costas of NBC created a bit of controversy during his coverage of the opening ceremony. It seems the Olympic Committee declined a request for a moment of silence for the Israeli athletes who were killed 40 years ago at the Olympics in Munich. Costas felt the decision was insensitive. He called for his own moment of silence as this year's Israeli athletes marched into the stadium. He said, "For many, Tonight, with the world watching, is the true time and place to remember those who were lost and how and why they died. NBC demonstrated their great sensitivity by promptly cutting to a commercial. Now, the whole mess has been called a slap in the face to the Israelis by some. Others feel that Costas was totally out of line. I can certainly see why those who died should be honored. I can also see how this could get totally out of hand. A lot of people have been killed in different ways. I can see how it could possibly trigger hostility. But, you know, the whole concept of Olympic Games based on national boundaries, national teams, well, that could trigger hostility too, couldn't it? It's great to have teams competing on a playing field rather than a battleground. I love that concept. But I have a serious concern with the very idea of nations. I think more in terms of a brotherhood of man or something like that. Actually, to be completely honest, sometimes I feel find myself not only ashamed to be an American, but ashamed to be human. Look at the way we act, we humans, we Americans, whatever. Which, if I were to go on that, expound on that topic, I'd probably end up monopolizing the whole show. So I don't want to do that. We have two very good guests tonight from the top and bottom of the East Coast as viewed on a conventional map. I look forward to hearing from both Sam Smith and Sherwood Ross, so I'd better get back on track what I was trying to say. Nations, I do have a problem with them, but nations are not inherently evil. And we, the people, we're not inherently evil. I'm pretty sure that even our leaders are not inherently evil. And for that matter, neither are the people or the leaders of the countries that some people consider to be our enemies. So why is it we are always fighting? Why must we continually manufacture reasons to take up arms against each other? Do we manufacture reasons so that somebody can manufacture arms and make money with it? Well, that's one possibility. I'm not sure I know the answer. I just have some questions. I'd like to play something from Bill Hicks.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome, as you said, Sam Smith and Sherwood Ross. Sam is living in Maine now. He used to live in Washington, D.C., and I believe Sherwood will be speaking to us from Coral Gables. So we're coming to you tonight from Coral Gables, somewhere in Maine, Fort Lauderdale, and Duluth. We at the New American Dream Radio Show want to say congratulations to the Transform Now Plowshares, three Americans who sneaked into the United States military nuclear weapons facility this past Saturday and took it down nonviolently. The Oak Ridge Y-12 nuclear weapons manufacturing facility has been shut down the past couple of days so that the base can re-examine base security. We would hope Barack Obama and his military thugs would also take this opportunity to re-examine the wisdom of having nuclear weapons at all, of spending millions on weapons of mass destruction while schools go without, health care goes without, human needs go without. We thank the three for taking on the United States military machine in such a decisive manner. This is a brief account of the story of the action. It's on the Transform Now Plowshares website, transformnowplowshares.wordpress.com. Michael R. Wally, age 63, Megan Rice, age 82, Greg Borchi Obed, age 57, succeeded in a disarmament action at the Oak Ridge Y-12 nuclear facility before dawn today. This was written on Saturday. Calling themselves Transform Now Plowshares, they hammered on the cornerstone of the newly built, highly enriched uranium manufacturing facility. They splashed human blood and left four spray-painted tags on the recent construction, which read, "Woe to the Empire of Blood, the fruit of justice is peace, work for peace, not war, and plowshares, please, Isaiah." Under the cover of darkness, they intermittently passed beyond four fences in a walk for over 2 hours through the fatal forest zone. "We feel it was a miracle. We were led directly to where we wanted to go," said Greg. After navigating through the complex, they came to a long, white, windowless building marked HEUMF. "It was built like a fortress," Greg said, describing the four guard towers. Unimpeded by security, they attached two banners to pillars of the building. "Transform Now Plowshares," read the first, with the green and black icon showing part bomb, part flower. A second stated, "Swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, Isaiah." In addition, between the pillars, they strung red crime tape. When confronted by a guard, they read aloud their statement. "He was on his walkie-talkie, but he heard it," Megan confirmed. Before receiving orders to halt, they had the opportunity to offer guards bread and display a Bible, candles, and white roses. Though initially forced to endure a kneeling posture for an extended period, guards responded to a complaint and allowed the activists to stand off and on. Meanwhile, they continued singing. And again, our congratulations to the Transform Now Plowshares for having confronted the and taken on the United States military. Go to transformnowplowshareswordpress.com. The Occupy movement has been going on for a long time. It's, I think it's probably still, I don't know myself personally, but I think it's probably being rejuvenated this past spring and summer. It's an amazing happening, an awakening. I hope it keeps going and going and growing. But to me, even if it succeeds, wait a minute, what could that mean? For it to succeed, it would be the end of America, and that would be great. America needs to end and be replaced by new America. Yes, that would be great. But still, at least to me, we absolutely still need to get to the root. Getting to the root is what radicals do, I think. We need to get to the truth about 9/11, about RFK, about JFK, about MLK, the assassinations of, about Waco, Oklahoma City. And maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just OCD over this stuff. Probably it's just me, but I have to get this on the front page of major newspapers, on TV news, even weekly newspapers. Even the Woodbury, Iowa Twiner. It's got to say that the CIA killed these people and Paul Wellstone, too. It's got to feature a four-column color photo of George Bush Jr. and Sr. being taken off to jail. Dick Cheney, Condoleezza, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, all the usual suspects. And maybe that can happen after the revolution. That's fine with me, but it has to happen sometime. It's again time for the New American Dream radio show, the American Russian novel, All We Need Is More Vodka Radio Hour, because we have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra. Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. Their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty because their relatives have sent them to Siberia with a roll of their eyes. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar, maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice. The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There is no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see, no JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes, no destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police, no evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long 10-year war and debacle to trial and put them on TV, just like OJ, every afternoon, so every American can watch. Just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession, what we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. And part of that is becoming the quality of people who are capable of telling the truth. Right now we live on lies, we subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know that, and yet they refuse to acknowledge what they know. They kill and continue to kill. They allow others to die and continue to send others to their deaths for a lie. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country, because our country is surely broken as well. We need a truth commission. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. The troops are not protecting us. That is somebody's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face-to-face with the empire, those who have begun to gather in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere as part of the Occupy movement. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He is complicit. He has lied. He has continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. And see, there is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. It went all the way into that hole, and no, there's no blood and no bodies and no luggage scattered or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like some Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own country and government. It's like a horror movie, and the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid. We pay for these lies. Some people struggling with two or three jobs, this lie that the military protects us, this lie that the USA stands for freedom, this lie that it's okay to kill. There is actually a they out there, and there actually is a you and a me, and together we are we. They, Bush, Obama, Clinton, and company want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters in 2001. We can do this, but we cannot be afraid.
The New American Dream radio show newsroom has received word that the Homeland Security obscene statue removal team taking part in Operation Bad Guys after they finished the Joe Paterno job at Penn State, they've now taken their bulldozers and cranes and chains and torches, ropes and dynamite on six flatbed trucks, four semi-trucks with a lead pickup and lights flashing. They're headed for the other jobs that will need to be completed before the end of the summer. Right now, Terraman's headed for the Ronald Reagan statue at the National Airport in Arlington, Virginia. Then on to the George W. Bush statue, Hamilton High School in Hamilton, Ohio. I'll head on down after that to the George H.W. Bush Monument in Houston, Texas. Then out to the Black Hills, to the Gerald Ford statue in Rapid City, South Dakota. Plans are underway to take out the Bill Clinton statue in Pristina, Kosovo, and the Barack Obama statue in Jakarta, Indonesia, with drone airplane attacks.
When you go to Walmart, not if, when, you will find those birthday cards in the birthday card section that tell all about what was happening during the year you were born. Big political events of 1955, the big songs, movies, celebrities. Well, thanks to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and Walmart, you can also get your FBI file included in your own birthday card. Your card will show who had dinner with who you had dinner with last Tuesday, where you went for vacation last summer, who you texted last Saturday night, and what movies you ordered last month from Netflix, along with photos of who you sat with at McDonald's for coffee this morning. Your FBI file birthday cards from Homeland Security and Walmart. Always low-quality scum suckers. Save your privacy for the graveyard. Live better. Happy birthday. You're not getting older. You're getting safer. You'll never get tired of this, will you? We're Walmart and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
Our first guest is an old friend, journalist Sam Smith, and right now we're having a little bit of trouble getting hold of him. I'm still trying to dial in.
Sam Smith is an award-winning alternative journalist, and he's also the editor of the Progressive Review. He's a writer and activist and social critic who has been at the forefront of new ideas and new politics for more than four decades. He's been editing alternative publications since 1964, longer than almost anyone in the country. I'll wait for when Chuck to see if Chuck can get a hold of Sam. He lived for a long time in D.C., I know, and I think he and his wife moved recently to Maine. Sam was on the show probably two or three times before, and there's a picture. There used to be a picture on his website of he interviewing John Kennedy. I think this was when he was Senator Kennedy, and I think it was just at the press conference that John Kennedy announced his candidacy for the presidency, and the picture shows JFK and I think Jacqueline Kennedy and also the young journalist Sam Smith holding a microphone or a pen, I'm not sure. But it's a cool picture if you can find it on the internet. Chuck, any luck?
I'm trying one more time. I think we might have to skip ahead, Mike.
Sam, let's just go to the next one.
Yeah, let's move right on.
Okay. Maybe you will be the next American Idiot. Auditions for American Idiot 2012 are being conducted next Saturday in room 203, the high school history classroom. You can study for the competition by reading the local high school history textbook. Copies available at the front desk up to the day of auditions. You may also prepare by reading your local newspaper, by watching the nightly news, the Today Show, Fox News, or by listening to National Public Radio. Winners of local competitions will advance to the regional finals in Waco, Oklahoma City, Memphis, Los Angeles, Eveleth, Minnesota, New York City, and Washington, D.C. The finals will be held at Dealey Plaza in Dallas. And the winner of the next American Idiot competition will be buried at sea on national television live, sponsored by Coca-Cola and Chevrolet. And now, get ready to be released for the Christian Christmas holiday movie season. My Big Fat American Auschwitz. There will be Muslims and terrorists and commies. Oh my, towel heads and Negroes and homos and liberals and tinfoils and wetbacks, poor people and you people and they people, oh my, eagles and beagles and Edelweiss, sauerkraut and six-packs, my big fat American Auschwitz, coming soon.
Box cutters, cave dwellers, jet fuel bringing down steel structures. They hate us because of our freedoms. Anyone who's not with us is against us. Osama bin Laden has been buried at sea. The CIA is known as the company. CIA agents are called assets. The CIA, for the past 60-some years, 70 years, has killed, murdered, cheated, lied, duped, fooled, and disrupted anyone working anywhere for fairness for the poor. The CIA is the arm of American business. President John F. Kennedy saw this and said he was going to dismantle the CIA. They killed him. Then they fooled you, all of us. We pay for the CIA with our tax dollars. We do not storm the CIA building and tear it down brick by brick. Box cutters, cave dwellers, Osama bin Laden confessing on some tapes that somebody said somebody found somewhere. Anthrax, George Bush elected, Barack Obama elected. Paul Wellstone's plane has crashed in the forest. Robert Kennedy murdered, never became president. Martin Luther King murdered, never brought poor people to occupy Washington to demand justice for the poor, taking money out of the pockets of the rich. CIA. Poverty's not the problem, it's the solution. The business of America is business. The CIA, the fist of American business for over 70 years. Apple pie, Chevrolet, baseball, grandma, and the CIA.
Chuck, do we have Sherwood online now, or
I'm calling him right now, Mike.
Okay, our next guest is Sherwood Ross. He's been a regular columnist for the New American Dream Radio Show for a long time. Sherwood lives in Coral Gables, Florida. He's an award-winning reporter. He worked for the Miami Herald and Chicago Daily News. He contributed a weekly column for a major wire service. He currently resides in Florida, as I mentioned. Chuck, do we have Sherwood? Here we go.
At least we have dialing this time.
We have
Sherwood.
Dialing.
Sherwood.
Yes.
This is Chuck Gregory at the New American Dream Radio Show.
How are you, Chuck?
I'm good. How are you, Sherwood?
I am very good.
Well, we'd
Sherwood,
like to hear.
Sherwood, we're on the air if you're ready.
Oh, I'm ready. You know, here's a question that still bothers me about 9/11, Chuck. You know, of all the families in this world, just what are the odds of the United States being attacked by members of a family that has long-standing business ties with our own president's family? Figure it this way. There are 7 billion people in the world, so figure about 1 billion families, maybe more or less. And out of all these 1 billion families, the U.S. gets attacked by the bin Ladens. And who are the bin Ladens? They are a Saudi Arabian family with long-standing ties to President Bush's family. Bigot. The two families were friends. They were collaborators. They were business partners. They did favors for each other. Now, are we supposed to believe that 9/11 was a mere coincidence and that there was no planning between the two families? That would not be a shocking one-in-a-thousand coincidence or one-in-a-million coincidence. It would be a shocking one-in-a-billion coincidence. So are we supposed to believe that of all the families in the world, a member of a Saudi Arabian family that is friendly to the president's family carried out the attack on America and there was no coordination? One in a billion? Are you kidding me? As it happened at the very time of 9/11, at the very hour of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon when they were under attack and innocent Americans were getting killed, members of the Bush and Bin Laden families were taking part in the meeting at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C. And after the attack, while smoke was still gushing from the wreckage of the Twin Towers, and when the skies were shut down to all aviation, President Bush arranged for the Bin Ladens to leave the country. That's something of a favor, too, don't you think? Seeing as some of them might be suspects who might face a murder rap. And even if none of them were involved, what did they know about the Osama Bin Laden family and Osama? You'd think the U.S. government and President Bush in particular might be just a wee bit curious about what the Bin Ladens knew. After all, the guy who allegedly made the attack was one of their clan. So of all the families in the world, how did the Bin Ladens get a free pass back to Saudi Arabia from George Bush? Cindy Rodriguez is a reporter for the Denver Post, and she wrote, quote, "The White House authorized planes to pick up 140 Saudi nationals, including 24 members of the Bin Laden family, living in various cities in the U.S. to bring them back to Saudi Arabia where they would be safe. They were never interrogated." How close was George W. Bush to the Bin Laden family? Well, they were at least friendly business partners. Did you know that President Bush founded his Texas oil company, Arbusto Energy, together with Osama Bin Laden's brother, Salem Bin Laden? That's right. President Bush earlier was a business partner of the brother of the man who allegedly made the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But that's not all. According to the Denver Post's Rodriguez, several Bin Laden family members invested millions in the Carlyle Group, a private global equity firm based in Washington, D.C. And who was the senior advisor of Carlyle? Why, none other than President George Bush's father, ex-President George H.W. Bush. And in the years before 9/11, he met with the Carlyle Group repeatedly. He met with the Bin Laden family in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in 1998. He met with them again in January 2000. And he met with them again the day before 9/11. That's right. George Bush, H.W. Bush, attended a conference in Washington that included Shafiq Bin Laden, the brother of Osama. Hey, there's another one-in-a-billion coincidence. Of all the companies in the world, ex-President Bush is an advisor to one that has an investor whose brother attacks America. Let's review. President George W. Bush is a former business partner of one of Osama bin Laden's brothers. his father, George H.W. Bush, was a partner with yet another Osama bin Laden brother. I don't know if I should bring this up, but it should be remembered that George H.W. Bush was a master of spycraft. He had the facilities of the CIA at his disposal. Before becoming president, he was director of the CIA, which is, in fact, one of the great criminal organizations of all time, with a reputation for double-crossing those it does business with, and an organization that will stop at nothing, including murder. That doesn't make the first President Bush a criminal, but it does mean he was in bed with a lot of thieves. In a word, the CIA has zero moral standards, and its interest has always been to lay its hands on the oil resources of the Middle East, which is why back in 1953 it engineered the overthrow of the elected democratic government of Iran. Well, I don't want to accuse either of the former Bush presidents of planning 9/11 with the bin Laden family or anything else like that. But what I am saying is we do need to reopen the 9/11 investigation, and we should broaden it to look at the role of the CIA. We also need to look at the oil companies that got the contracts after the U.S. invaded Iraq and see if any of that oil money flowed directly or indirectly into the coffers of the CIA. And one oil kingpin in particular who needs to be looked at, who got a big oil contract in Iraq, was Ray Hunt of H.L. Hunt Oil of Dallas, Texas, a man who was very closely associated with George W. Bush. You know, the idea that of all the families in the world, a bin Laden family member just happened to lead the attack on America, and it was coincidental, and it was not planned with the Bush family, may be true. I certainly hope the Bush family is innocent. I really hope they are. But the odds of a coincidence like this happening are about 1 in a billion. Maybe my math is wrong. I sure wish I was better at math. Gee, I hope I'm mistaken. I'm sure with Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Thank you, Sherwood, and have a good night.
You too.
It seems that Sam Smith has joined us, and since we already told you who he was, we're going to jump right in. Sam, you're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
Doing all right. A little foggy here in Maine, but otherwise fine.
Okay. What have you been up to lately? I know you keep awfully busy. Every time I go to your website, I see more new news.
Yeah, well, it just keeps sort of pouring in. I got to tell you, though, that this is one of the weirdest presidential campaigns I've seen for a couple of reasons. One is that I can't recall one which has been as tight as this for as long. I mean, we're talking basically about 2 months in which neither candidate has broken out of the mathematical tie area. And the second is that I can't think of another campaign in which it's been so unclear what both candidates really think and what they plan to do.
I might almost say if they think, but that's a little bit too
much. But I mean, it is strange, and I think sort of what we're seeing in part is the ultimate triumph of public relations over reality, and it's just very hard to get at any element of truth.
Yes, I think truth has become more and more scarce in the last few years. And,
well, it's not very valued either.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. You know, I noticed in one of the write-ups about you that you were one of the early, one of the people who helped to create sort of a predecessor of the Green Party?
Yeah, I was one of the people who put that together. And I now find myself, I have for a number of years in the, I call myself a backyard green, because my view of political activism is it really works best from the bottom up. But we're living in a time in which people assume that you make change from the top down, and even that's true of the Greens. So they put, I think, an excessive emphasis on presidential campaigns and not enough on grassroots activity. Just for an example, the populace had something like 10,000 missionaries going around the country pushing their case. And if you look at the three parties that really made a difference, third parties that really made a difference, the progressives, the populists, and the socialists, in all three cases, they really only had one or two chances of even getting into double digits in the presidential campaign. So I'm sort of an outlaw in the Green Party at the moment, but come the end of November, I guess I'll be back in again.
Do you...
I grew up thinking that there was a difference between politics and religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of faith, and it's not a matter of showing how good you are. It's a matter of putting something together with either thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of other people. And so you have to take a little bit different approach. I mean, one point I said about Nader, my friend Ralph Nader, I said, you know, it doesn't help, even if you're 100% right, to stand out in the middle of Route 95 at rush hour and try to make your point.
That's certainly true. You have to build something, as you say, from the bottom up.
Right.
We spoke last week with Ben Mansky, the campaign manager for Jill Stein.
Good guy.
Yeah, he seemed like a real good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he echoed your thoughts about grassroots campaign. Of course, he's in the midst of pushing a presidential campaign. My problem, well, it's the traditional problem with any third party campaign. You worry that your candidate, whoever that might be, is going to lose votes to the third candidate. Third party and end up losing when he might have won otherwise.
Yeah, in fact, I think the last time that may have happened was with Ross Perot rather than with a leftist candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Bill Clinton got in because of Ross Perot.
Uh-huh.
Now, as far as Nader goes, if you go back to the 2000 race, there's this mythology that Nader was responsible for Gore's loss. That simply isn't true. If you go back and you look at the polling, what you find is that Nader never had more than maybe 1-3% of the polls. But that what happened in the closing weeks of the campaign was that Gore lost considerable margin.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that Nader, because Nader's vote was essentially, if you look over the course of the campaign, it was pretty steady. But Gore lost ground. There's no doubt about that. And so I think that in that case, it was Gore's fault. But I think that's less important than the fact is that ultimately what you're trying to do is to produce change. And one of the things that I've found with third-party candidates generally is they have a hard time understanding that they're not just politicians, but they're also involved in a they're meant to be involved in a movement. And when I was one of the people who helped to start the D.C. Statehood Party, and one of the reasons we started that was because we had started back in the 60s fighting freeways in Washington, and we realized that we needed some sort of political foundation, so we started a third party. But that didn't mean that we gave up the movement side of it. What's happened now is that there's a tendency for people to think only in terms of the politics. So the question I always ask folks is, I ask them, you know, what are you going to do the day after election, after you lose? And that always stuns them. You know, I even asked that question of Dennis Kucinich once, and he got sort of annoyed. But I think it's a perfectly good question, because what you're doing in the campaign is that you are, in a sense, organizing people. You're getting names. You're getting people excited. And then you're suddenly turning around, and you've lost the election, and what do? If you do nothing, then you've wasted all that effort.
What would you propose that people might do?
Well,
is there some way they can make use of that organization to do something else?
Yeah. I think you know, the left right now is in some of its worst shape that I've seen in my lifetime. Just in terms of organization, there are lots of reasons for that. Some of which people don't pay a lot of attention to. But for example, I think that there's this tendency now for groups to stay in their own niche, so that if you're an environmental group, you don't even think about what the women's movement might mean to your cause, or how you might have something in common. And I think that's one of the weaknesses. But what I suggested in the case of the Obama campaign was, I said, you know, I'm planning to vote for Obama because it's not because of a choice of candidates, but because of a choice of battlegrounds. I would rather fight the Democrats than have to fight Mitt Romney and an all-Republican Congress.
Okay.
So that's one thing. Second of all, I propose that we have a one-night stand with Obama. In other words, your relationship with Obama will consist of not literally one night, but one day, going to the polls and voting for him. The minute you come back, there needs to be a organizations need to be ready to announce what it is they plan to do during the next Obama administration. And just as an example, I think something that could happen even before the election, which could have a huge impact, would be if black and Latino groups came together. Because one of the things that drives mainstream conservative politics is the assumption, which is relatively successful, that blacks and Latinos will never get together. Because if they did, it would be a very politically powerful combination.
That's just true.
One example. You know, you come up with an agenda of no more than, say, 5 to 10 items. And these should be items which are not designed to please a particular niche in the liberal or progressive movement, but are ones that will please the people who you're trying to reach. And that means primarily economic issues. I mean, I ran a little question today. I said, you know, is Chick-fil-A really more important than foreclosures, unemployment, and the drought? I mean, it's not a question of either or. But if you're out there trying to get people to vote for you who have never been involved in any of the sort of standard liberal or progressive things, you know, you got to deal with issues that will get to them.
That certainly makes sense. And besides, you know, this whole Chick-fil-A thing, I mean, I hate what the guy said, but Hey, at least he said what he thought. That's kind of unusual.
Yeah, and exactly where, other than in terms of rhetoric, does his position on gay marriage differ from Barack Obama's?
Hmm.
You know, which is something which hasn't been raised. But I think the main thing is, it's not, I mean, my approach to gay marriage, I say to somebody who criticizes gay marriage, I say, if you don't like gay marriage, don't marry a gay.
Right, exactly.
I mean, but hidden behind that idea is a principle that is very hard for people to grasp hold of, is that one of the reasons America got where it is because we were willing to tolerate people being different than ourselves.
Exactly. And
that is not, it hasn't been universal, but right now my feeling is that both the right and the left are essentially taking a Puritan approach to positions. And the Puritans believed that your freedom was defined by your community. You know, as long as you obeyed the rules of the community, you could be free. But there were other approaches, and one of the other approaches was that you found in the mid-Atlantic states, more, which is more like the Quakers. The Quakers were an example of this, where they said that I can't have my liberty unless you have your liberty. And I realize this. I have a very strong sense of this because I'm the third of six children, so I've lived with this problem all my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got two of my sisters are way to the right of me.
Mm.
And I know that they're very different. Each of them are quite different. I mean, I enjoy very much being with one and not so much with the other. But you also learn in that sort of situation to deal with these problems in a slightly different way.
Well, I'm completely convinced that we could all get along if we could just managed to talk seriously and not totally dismiss other ideas.
That's
we may
right.
not agree, but we, you know, the old agree to disagree really makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And then what's the standard for? The standard is that you can't take a position that's going to really hurt somebody. You know, I mean, that's worth fighting over.
Absolutely.
And that's what the civil rights movement was about.
Yep.
And the anti-gay stuff is right in there. The difference is that if you're trying to get people to the point you want, it's unlike the 60s when Lyndon Johnson was president and an awful lot of civil rights legislation was passed, the progressives today really don't have anything to say to the bulk of middle America.
Hmm.
And, you know, when you had things coming down the line like, improvements in people's economic conditions, and you're also saying that now you've got to treat blacks equally. Well, it's a different ball game than if you're only talking about gay marriage and you're not talking about foreclosures.
Right.
And I get very frustrated by this because to me this seems so obvious and natural, and I guess it's in part, I guess, because I was an anthropology major, so I just sort of assume that you live in societies with different, subcultures, and you have to learn to figure out how to work that out. But we have gotten into a pretty evangelical attitude on both sides now, I think.
It's just highly polarized.
Yeah.
Well, Sam, I've enjoyed visiting with you. You've brought up some great points, but we are out of time.
Well, enjoy talking with you, and just hang in there and see what happens next.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and we'll have you back again real soon.
Thanks a lot. Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
Tonight's show also being sponsored by the classic hit TV show Dancing with the Stars. The Stanley Kubrick movie of the Apollo moon landings. Yeah, we went to the moon. It's on TV right after My Favorite Martian, before Bewitched. It was real. Get over it. Dancing with the Stars. We know if it's on TV, it's reality.
At the end of the day, remember that this day was brought to you by Operation Northwoods Spray Deodorant. With Operation Northwoods, the fog hangs in the air long after you're gone. Back a few decades ago, some people in government planned to carry out murders and crash airplanes and have fake news reports to fool the American people into invading Cuba. It didn't happen only because John F. Kennedy, a real president, was in office. But then the ones who liked the idea of Operation Northwoods killed Kennedy. And now we have fake everything, fake presidents, fake news, and fake wars. Oh, the killing and dying are real. It's just that everything else is baloney. Operation Northwoods, it hangs in the air.
And now we bring you the new American Dream masterpiece classic Playhouse Theater something something. Real voices with a message you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News. Tonight, Charles Bukowski. This is a world where everybody's got to do something. You know, somebody laid down this rule that everybody's got to do something. They got to be something. You know, dentist, glider pilot, a narc, a janitor, a preacher, all that. Sometimes I just get tired of thinking of all the things that I don't want to do, all the things I don't want to be, places I don't want to go, like India, like getting my teeth cleaned, save the whale, all that. I don't understand it. Charles Bukowski, 1987. It was true that I didn't have much ambition, but there ought to be a place for people without ambition. I mean, a better place than the one usually reserved. How in the hell can a man enjoy being awakened at 6:30 a.m. by an alarm clock, leap out of bed, dress, four speed, shit, piss, brush teeth and hair, fight traffic to get to a place where essentially, you made lots of money for somebody else and were asked to be grateful for the opportunity to do so. Charles Bukowski. The average American citizen, male breadwinner, is a horror to behold. He's a sight to make one vomit blood and gut and hope all up. For even when he smiles, even when he is kind, even when he is a winner, a lover, a father, a playboy, a champ, he stinks. He's rotten. He's a flower without a head, a plant without a root, a slab of meat butchered and dressed in clothing. Charles Bukowski. The 9-to-5 is one of the greatest atrocities sprung upon mankind. You give your life away to a function that doesn't interest you. This situation so repelled me, I was driven to drink, starvation, and mad females, simply as an alternative. Charles Bukowski. There's nothing to mourn about death any more than there is to mourn about the growing of a flower. What's terrible is not death, but the lives people live or don't live up until their death. They don't honor their own lives. They piss on their lives. They shit them away. Dumb fuckers. They concentrate too much on fucking, movies, money, family, fucking. Their minds are full of cotton. They swallow God without thinking. They swallow country without thinking. Soon they forget how to think. They let others think for them. Their brains are stuffed with cotton. They look ugly. They talk ugly. They walk ugly. Play them the great music of the centuries. They can't hear it. Most people's deaths are a sham. There's nothing left to die. Charles Bukowski.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. The local newspaper editor is already fighting the rumor of the proposed construction of a new prison near town. His father was also a newspaper man. He despises the term embedded, and he thinks Tom Brokaw, Ben Bradley, Bob Woodward, Wolf Blitzer, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, probably Walter Cronkite as well, were all CIA. It Begins in the Heart was one of the editor's most recent editorials about the need for a new American revolution. He had said that if there were to be a revolution in America, it would come from the center, from the heart, the land, the heartland. It would be something to turn the thousands of church buildings into more than social halls, and it would happen here. Because here, some folks have it within themselves to know right from wrong. Otherwise, what was he doing here? You can't go about your delightful day letting other people scrounge in the dirt for scraps from your table and then act all excited and surprised when they try to snatch a sliver of pie from your kitchen window. That's what he said. He hopes his writing will perhaps get him out of Mount Liberty. Somehow an editor in Sioux Falls or Worthington or Fremont will find him and invite him to a real newsroom. Maybe that boss would let him do his job, the job of any good newspaper reporter confronted with small-town hysteria over some stupid thing. He would face it down with his Macintosh, like a sheriff in the street, telling the lynch mob, "That'll be far enough, boys."
Because he's the editor-in-chief, every goddamn morning the grass fire of the day's worries surrounds Jackson Cornwall III, threatening to devour him as he shoves through the Wednesday Miracle Class front door. Actually, he wanted to write, not edit, but this was the job offered. They need the money. The radio blared from the empty desk of the sports reporter. "Hello, Mount Liberty. This is KWML on your AM dial, bringing you the hits of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and your work week weather forecast." "What do you got for today?" Cornwall asked Kurt, one of his two reporters. "Well, there's a supervisor's meeting, the pets parade at the nursing home. Somebody said something to Tori's cousin about a fire somewhere last night." "Is Paula in?" Cornwall asked. "Haven't seen her yet. I'm going next door. I'll have a meeting when I get back." Jackson wants Kurt's job to just be a reporter. Everyone liked the stories that Jackson wrote when he got the time. They told him so. He wrote about school boards and war heroes and flower gardens and parades. What he really wanted were murders and robberies with strings of guts caked to the wallpaper. At big paper, he'd shine. He'd write about important things. Not like the story yesterday about how the wheelchair club petitioned the city council to put in ramped curbs downtown. He needs to be a hero. He figures he's not a good enough person to just be normal. He doubts they'd let him be a hero in Mount Liberty. What is there to be a hero about around here? He had a chance he could be super writer. Shove through the door just before deadline, punch out literature about the things he discovered that day. Hang a cigarette out his mouth. Jackson had read that Jimmy Breslin did it that way in New York. Jackson wants to be able to write about the castaways, the forgotten ones around town, the way Breslin wrote about the murder victims and the regular guys who stumbled into the path of the oncoming establishment. To the rescue comes the writer with a telling detail about a lucky strike ash about to fall just as the rich guy is turned back. Once Jackson turned out a good column about the grocery store checkout crew, how even though only in high school they took their time to talk to the old ladies when they pushed their carts to their cars, how the old people like that. But no guns. Jackson believes in Mount Liberty because he walks past the Crispy Cafe each morning on his way to the office, comes back as soon as he can to sit and relax and have his coffee. He knows there's a certain spark in the cafe, beginning with the man hunched over the griddle, the born-again owner wearing the white stained T-shirt with the inscription, "The cook's on fire." Jackson looks inside the front window, past the red checkered curtains and the stenciled inscription and the high school sports posters. He sees Mayberry, Metzger's Field, and Hooterville. He sees men drinking coffee from thick, snow-white cups with hands stained with real dirt that will never come off. He sees grandmas and grandpas holding on to each other over the table as if clinging to both sides of a raft in the middle of the sea. He sees high school boys and girls at the counter drinking pop that they don't even taste because they're so excited to be talking about whatever and it will never, ever taste as sweet as right now, this moment now. No, it's gone. Save it. It's gone. He sees the dawn sheep judging at the county fair, a winter's morning sunlight on the water tower, and Jesus. The bell atop the front door jingled like Rudolph as Jackson walked in. 9 round metal stools at the counter face a Wells Blue Bunny calendar hanging from 3 swatches of duct tape on a 10-foot mirror. The Crispy opens at 5 a.m. Through the day, groups gather in the booths and around the 10 tables, sipping coffee, rebuking anything that they've heard on the radio or in the daily papers. The 535 construction workers crouch silently in the middle of the room, clutching life jacket mugs to keep them out of the day's chill for 2 more minutes. The mid-morning business crowd displays themselves in the front 2 booths. Later, the mid-afternoon retired men pull 2 tables together in the back by the restrooms to play hearts and fart. The checkout sits at the south end of the counter on a glass case filled with Baby Ruth bars, red and yellow suckers, and year-old junior mints. An open matchbox of mint toothpicks cozies up next to the register like an old hound. Waitress Chandra Schumann wears her hair short. Used to be in a beehive. Wore that a bun. This year, she had to shop trim it to get that hair off her neck for the summer. The uniform she has on has been left in the wash with a red towel, and she's just going to have to wear it now. With the grace of a figure skater, she steps around canes, crackers, and pacifiers, sliding over the white and black tile between her tables. She works Monday through Saturday, 5 to 2. The owner and his wife cook breakfast, lunch, and supper, help with the tables and register. Each summer, a different class holds its reunion in the Crispy. It used to be the carousel until it burned, and the born-again cook bought it from his old boss and held a contest to rename it. He let everybody vote between Crispy and Phoenix. During the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, place with the high school hangout. Before McDonald's, Dairy Queen, and Taco John's sprang up along the highway. Chandra rushes across a floor gouged with black boot scuff marks, maybe some still there from 1932 when the farmers crowded inside before they stormed the 8th County Courthouse to stop the forced sale of Garner Warner's farm. Out in the grove, beyond the old Lutheran cemetery, they had the noose pulled tight around the neck of the grizzled judge who would not agree to stop foreclosing on farms when the National Guard arrived, bayonets drawn. Today, Jackson Cromwell, the editor, needs to make a list of stories for this week's issue. Remember to go to the manager's meeting at noon, make it to one of his daughter's track meets sometime before the season ends. Sat down in his customary front window booth, prepared for the solitary comfort of eating. Food could not be enjoyed any other way. Taped to his office desk, he kept a permanent to-do list. Cafe, meditate, run. He did not meditate or run, but if he kept the pressure on, someday he might. Jackson looked out the window to think. Nods and waves to the State Farm agent, because he has to. Looks back down at his notes. Having lived in this area most of his life, Jackson knows that all around here for miles, handmade signs and boards rented from U-Haul dot the landscape. Are you a slave to alcohol? If your Bible is in good shape, you probably aren't. God bless America. We support our troops. He's also aware that there are pockets of cynical populists that inhabit the backcountry. If he never gets to the big paper, maybe they'll save him, pull his spirit out of the blue haze of the television glow and into the light. They don't put messages on their lawns. They send joke suggestions to Garrison Keillor and review new fiction for The New Yorker. Their great-grandfathers loved Eugene Debs and Robert La Follette and learned to despise Woodrow Wilson. Their great-grandmothers admired Dorothy Day and Jeanette Rankin. And they learned at their knees about a day when life was hands-on, when people read and cared about what was happening and followed the deeds of national leaders as if they were sitting at the weekly sales barn auction or reading the minutes of the local school board meeting or co-op association. They go to church meetings and school plays, realizing they enter and exit always slightly out of step with their neighbors. At election time, they enter the middle school gym with seed corn caps in hand, write in their wildest hopes, and go home to milk, leaving the radio on into the night. They mow their lawns, scoop their walks, looking up every now and again at the sound of the city's snowplow scraping and listening for the revolution.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security part-time summer help bounty hunters are about average.
We'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. We also thank our sponsors, thespiritualun.org, worldnewstrust.com, and June2508.com. Join us again, same time, same place, next week. Thank you, and good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.